quite happy now to be joined by Tom Scholz. And this guy was the founder of the band Boston, the inventor of the I Hear My Marianne Walking Away right now. Hey, Tom, when that album came out, Boston, during the bicentennial, that album today is one of those albums that still holds up and it is just as fresh as it ever is. What happened to have such a fantastic debut album like that?
Boy, you're asked. I have no idea. I thought it was going to be a flop. I went back to work at Polaroid after I finished that album. No one was more surprised than I was that it, became a smash hit. That was surprising enough, but to have people still be excited about the music, 35 years later, I have no explanation for it, but I'm not complaining.
Well, we want to tell everybody Boston has a tour coming up for the new album, Life, Love, and Hope. It's going to kick off in Hollywood, Florida, at the Seminole Hard Rock on June 5th. And if you're listening here in the Bay Area, they'll be at Shoreline on August 2nd here, late in the summer. But, Tom, for me as a rock fan, and I was in junior high when that album came out, like right at the sort of my most influential point, and some of the great albums, and that album still top 10 my whole life, had such a unique sound. What was it about you guys that you just sounded different than everybody else?
You know, the music was basically sort of my last shot at self-expression musically. I had been trying to, I'd been writing music and trying to make recordings for years, and finally, in the mid-70s, I just decided I was going to take one more shot at it. I was going to do it all myself. It was just going to be music exactly the way I liked it, nothing else. I was going to play all the parts, and so I did this demo. I worked with a drummer friend of mine named Jim Mesdia, and of course I had asked Brad to come in and sing the vocals for it. And so I wasn't really expecting anything. It was just I had been at it for so many years, and I had decided this was going to be my last shot at it. I'd basically spent all the money I had earned working as a design engineer for about 6 years, and all of my spare time, and this was going to sort of be my swan song. I was going to make this demo, send it out. Wasn't going to expect anything, but then I was finished. So, of course, I was very surprised that suddenly I actually was getting responses from major labels. So the rest of it has, from that point on, has just been a kind of a fantasy. After living with total failure for the first 6 years, I tried to record. I never expected to have a success.
Speaking with Tom Scholz of Boston, and when you say you worked at Polaroid, people might think that you worked at a photo mat or something. You're a guy who went to MIT, and you never even picked up a guitar until you were old enough to legally drink. I mean, it's amazing to me, because most people, you think like these prodigy, like all the guys I knew who were good, they were good at 16, And so what was it where you're like, I always wanted to do that, or did you just start tinkering around and say, hey, I'm actually kind of good at this?
No, I love music, and I didn't really get into rock and roll music until I heard the Kinks and the Yardbirds. Up to that point, I had no interest in rock, in pop music before that. I wasn't a huge Elvis fan. I just didn't care. But as soon as I heard that, as soon as I heard the Kinks and the Yardbirds and the Animals, then I got the bug. So from that point on, I started more seriously playing. I wasn't expecting to, do it as a profession. I just wanted to be able to do it, period. I didn't really start playing guitar till I was in college. It did take a few years to guitar was a lot harder than I thought it was going to be.
Did you practice right on out in the streets, as you say, as a lyric?
Well, sometimes I practiced out on the balcony of my third floor apartment in Brighton, but people on the street heard me.
Well, what about lyrics? I mean, you were able to find out that
Now that I think of it, a uh-huh. few of them yelled at me, too.
Well, little did they know they were yelling at the great Tom Scholz at the time. And then lyrically, you were able to find out that smokin' rhymes with token. And other things like that. What was it like writing those lyrics? Because I've always, it was one of those bands that you actually could hear what they were singing.
Well, I did write most of the lyrics to nearly all the songs, but that particular song, Smokin', Brad Delp wrote most of the lyrics to that song, so mm-hmm. I have to give a nod to him. Mm-hmm. That was one of the songs that we co-wrote. There were, there were a handful over the years. I never thought as I was writing the lyrics to the songs or making the recordings that anybody was going to hear them. I really expected that I was sort of doing it for my own to finish something that I had started. Now we go places and play the music and people know all the words. In fact, I've played at shows where the whole audience is singing along, and I start to sing along while I'm playing, and I realize I don't know some of the lyrics. It is a little embarrassing.
Well, let me ask you about this, because when I think a lot of guys in my generation, and I'm 48, and we all wanted to be lead guitarists or singers or bassists or drummers, and I had one of these Ibanez tube screamers, and it made my guitar sound so much cooler. But the Rockman amp, I just had someone call earlier in the show saying that he had the original and had just changed the way that he was able to play. What was it about that amp where, was it sort of necessity, was the mother of invention? You weren't getting the sound you were getting from the over-the-counter ones?
No, the reason that I built it was that I wanted a practice amp that I could take with me anywhere. There was no way to, there was just no way to practice guitar without having, a big monster amp with you and all kinds of other garbage. I thought, how hard can it be? All I wanted is a practice amp, and I decided it should be a headphone amp so that I could do it anywhere without annoying everybody. Mm-hmm. What I set out to do was to duplicate as nearly as possible the sound that I was using on stage. In a little box. My goal and my mission statement for it was it had to be the size of a peanut butter sandwich, which, by the way, just barely fits into the little compartment in a Les Paul guitar case. And that's why it has the dimensions it has. That's the size it fits in the case. So that's what I set out to do. I was very happy with the way it turned out. I now had a practice amp, as did lots of other people. But it was a successful design. They're not all of them are, by the way. People started using it on stage. I got a picture from Todd Rundgren, who had mounted four of them to a board and with a pedal to switch between the four units to get mm-hmm. the different sounds that it could get live. So at that point, I started thinking, well, maybe I should build a version of this that's, controllable and adjustable that people could use on stage. And that turned into Rockman, actual professional amplifier equipment, which is what we use on stage. It's basically a grown-up version of the Rockman headphone amp. So somehow it went full circle, because these heads that we use on stage, I mean, it takes two people to pick them up. They're huge. And somehow I set out to make a little tiny thing that I could put in my guitar case, and then I turned it back into a giant thing that I couldn't move anywhere.
A couple more questions for Tom Scholz. And when you talk about that bicentennial year, you're basically in 1 year, you go from unknown act to a headliner. But when you started getting hot, and you're opening for Foghat and Blue Oyster Cult, I'm a huge Sabbath fan, and I know you opened for them. Did you hang out with Iommi and Ozzy and Geezer? And did you hang out with those guys at all?
I personally didn't. I mean, I met them, but I had no time at all on those tours. Mm-hmm. I was doing so many different things. I was doing you know, figuring out the, I had to figure out the sequences, I had to figure out the segues between the songs, how to get the, you know, an arrangement that had, you know, perhaps 10 or 12 instrumental performances, which I had, of course, overdubbed in the studio to create the album, how to get that out of a five-piece band, and even things such as the set design and the technical parts of, like, reproducing the effect of a double-tracked guitar with a single guitar. There was actually all sorts of custom equipment that was that I had to design and get operable and then keep working on stage in order to do those shows. So I had a really full schedule, and there was no spare time at all. I was when we left on that first opening tour, it was I was basically working from the moment I got up until just a little bit before I went to bed. I always had a drink at the end of the day. I had to.
Well,
but I had very little time to socialize, so unfortunately, I kind of missed that whole part of it.
Well, and with the Brad Delp tragedy, I mean, you think about how, you know, with Bon Scott, how would AC/DC get another singer? I know that the singer you have now, tell people who don't know him, because this guy was a fan, and how did you find him?
Tommy DiCarlo was a Boston fan, and I don't know if it was a YouTube track or a link to something that he sent to us, which was him singing "Don't Look Back," and you know, I don't pay much attention to these things because I'm basically just always too busy, but my wife does, and I walk into the kitchen one day in 2007, and she's got "Don't Look Back" playing on her computer, and I said, "Oh," and I recognized that it wasn't the studio recording. I said, "Oh, what show was that?" And she said, "It's not Boston." And I said, "Oh yeah, that's Brad Delp singing." Mm. And she says, "No, it's not. It's some guy who's." And so I took the computer and I plugged it into my big system in the studio and listened to it. And I said, "Oh my God, this is not the band playing. This is a karaoke track, and this guy is singing it exactly like the recording." So that's how we discovered Tommy DiCarlo. We didn't really discover him.
Gotcha.
We stumbled on him.
Well,
he'd never been in a band before.
Wow, that's pretty awesome. And you know, it's funny because back in the day when I was growing up, you had an album. And I know this is going to sound cliche, but you would like sit in a beanbag chair and you'd just hold the album. And you'd sometimes have liner notes, sometimes you'd have the words to the songs, you'd have the lyrics. But the guitar spaceships with the blue flames, you know, that is so iconic at the time. And what was it about the album art that made you guys say, "Hey, let's make a spaceship that's a guitar"?
Well, the music to me, of course, is it's my escape, and it's the what I'm hoping for when people listen to it is that it would be an escape for them. And I'm a huge science fiction nut. I always have been, and always been fascinated with flight and space travel. Of course, a lot of the sounds that I make on the recordings are pretty spacey, or maybe just spaced out, I don't know. But my thought was, wouldn't it be cool if there was like a spaceship that was somehow a guitar? That's all I had to do with that idea, because the artist, Roger Heisen, that came up with that that artwork, that's all he got. A guitar that is a spaceship, and that and the music was all he had to go on. So it was just a fantastic interpretation of that idea. Very lucky. It was one of the few things that I didn't have to do myself, that somebody contributed that really helped make the whole thing work.
And finally, when your name is Boston, you're going to be affiliated with Red Sox Nation and the Seas and the Patriots and the Bees and everything. And
all of that's good in my eyes, by the way.
Yeah, well, I know you're a fan, but I mean, what's that like when these teams are embracing you? Because, and listen, if the music stunk, they probably wouldn't embrace you. But you're named Boston, and they like the music. What are those relationships like?
Well, you know, again, I'm always working. I don't go out much, so I've only met a handful of sports figures. But I have played basketball. I have played ball with a few of them. I scored a few 3-point shots on ML Carr one day, which I'm sure he was surprised at as much as I was. But I love watching sports when I have the time, and it's I find it like really relaxing, gets my mind off of everything else, and I'm a diehard fan of the Red Sox, Celtics, the Pats. I don't know. I think you inherit that, or somehow it becomes a part of you if you live in the Boston area. You sort of can't help it.
All right, and let's talk a little bit. We just have time. By the way, I want to remind everybody, go to bandboston.com online. Once again, bandboston.com. But you've got the new album out, the new tour. Tell us what the genesis of that was.
Well, the album, of course, was a 10-year-long project, so that was a very arduous one of those things I started that I just felt I had to finish. I really didn't expect that it was going to take that long when I undertook it. But now that it's done and it's out, and the we had a lot of success with the first single release, so it gives us something else to do on the tour. We are going to play a few tunes from that album, It was great to finally be able to get ready for a tour and not have that, finishing that album hanging over me. So I got to tell you, this is like having a new lease on life, being able to go out and not worrying about finishing a record when I get back.
Well, Tom, you think about it. I'm looking at these tour dates. This is a classic grind. I mean, you are doing one show, a lot of back-to-back nights. And I think it's really cool, as I said, I'm a rock fan from the 70s, that you're ending up at Budokan. That is pretty darn cool to be live there in Tokyo.
We're very excited about going back to Tokyo. I haven't been there in a long time. It was amazing back, when I went there in the late 70s. So very excited about that, as is everyone. Anxious to get the show back out on the road again. We had a great time in 2012. We did like 50 shows, but we only did the eastern half of the U.S. So this time we're doing a lot more shows, and we're going to make sure we cover all of North America.
Yeah, I want to remind everybody he'll be here in San Francisco in the Bay Area anywhere at the Shoreline August 2nd. The next night, I might have to go up to there. I got up in Tahoe. You're going to be at Harvey's at the Outdoor Arena at the South Shore. The new album is called Life, Love, and Hope, available on Frontiers Records. We've been speaking with Tom Scholes from Boston. Hey, it's a real thrill to talk to you. After all these years, I had the Boston posters on my walls as a kid in the bunk beds and everything. And as I said, it's a real thrill to get to talk to you. So congratulations on the new album, and hopefully we'll get to talk to you again down the road.
Rick, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. And yes, I would love to see it.
All right, I'm going to come backstage and say, remember me, and then you can say no. All right. That's Tom Scholes from Boston. I'm Rick Tittle. Come on back on Sports Byline.
Once I thought life was easy, I thought love would be